All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back.
That's right, that's
right. It's going to be us. We can drink and talk shit as much as we want. Nobody can say anything to us.
D.L. Hughley, uncut.
Well, it is D.L. Hughley Uncut. I am D.L.Q. I feel like I'm doing a...
What's with that open? Well.
I want to do something
full
different.
Full of energy.
Every time they say uncut, I think I'm uncircumcised. But I am. I am circumcised.
I cannot unhear that.
I am.
Very strange.
Oh, great. We just lost Atlanta.
As we should.
I'm D.L. Hughley.
I'm Jasmine Sanders.
What's up, Black J here? J. Phillips.
You know what's interesting to me? Of course, the debates are very interesting to me. That's going to happen tonight, right? The debate is going to happen tonight. Mm. And I don't want to be one of those people. I don't give a fuck if all Joe Biden does is hum the thing from Hee Haw. That motherfucker still got my vote.
That's yeah. it.
I think that's all he has to do, actually, right. If you think about
he
it.
He could shit on stage. I'd be like, ah!
Yeah.
All he has to do is keep saying, run the tape.
That's all he has to do. And so I think a lot of people are like me because I, to be fair, made up my mind in January of 2016. I made up my mind. I knew what I would do.
Absolutely.
And I think that people knew what they would do on the other side. People knew that no matter what he did, they would do it. And people are, too often they concentrate on his number, like how immovable his number is. But basically, his number is around 40%. And people that hate him have been about a little over 50%. And they're just as unmovable as him.
Yeah.
As much as you love him, as much as I hate him.
Yeah.
As much you
can. And what's crazy is you know that there are people who were on his side who have now flipped. But I doubt very seriously that there are people who weren't on his side that have now flipped to his side.
Ain't no new.
Right. Ain't not gonna happen.
Ain't no new Trump. If you're a new Trump supporter, you just lied the first time. It's when you steal all the fucking mailboxes.
Yeah.
Like I was in Pennsylvania, and they make it so much harder to vote. They have to put the mail-in ballot in what's called an honor envelope.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to put an envelope in an envelope. You dig what I'm saying?
An envelope in an envelope.
Yeah, for sure. I got them both covered.
Right. I saw a special that they did on that where they were showing just how hard it was for them to actually collect it and officially collect the vote. There's a, you know, you have to sign the ballot inside of it and put it in there properly. And there's a person that opens all of these and matches your signature to the DMV signature that's on file. And that's the only way that it qualifies.
And I just think there's something particularly in cities when people try to make it that much harder to vote.
It is. Yeah. You saw what they were doing. They're trying to investigate, I guess, this contribution that Bloomberg made for the people in Florida,
right.
The felons, to vote. And I'm thinking to myself, so wouldn't you want them to exercise their right to vote?
I personally think a couple of things. I think that voting should be mandatory, much like jury duty.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should have to do it. I think that too many people, our decisions are made by people that don't vote. Like more people that don't vote decide what happens in America than people that do, followed by old people.
Yeah.
So,
well, if you don't vote, you actually have voted.
The America's in the shape it's in because it's apathetic and old people who are deciding its future.
Yeah.
And it's insane to me. And I think, you know, when you got to put your envelope in another envelope, I mean, how rough is Pennsylvania? You got to have a bulletproof vest around your voting or your ballot. I don't even know what the fuck that is. It is. Jay had this, we do the radio show together, and you know that.
Right.
And so I called you because I heard, I was working, I heard with Charles Barkley, and Shaquille said about the Breonna, and it hurt me to my, like it really hurt me because I can't remember, and they were basically saying that, you know, you can't compare that to George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery. And I'll tell you why I think that's different. But what hurt me the most is you would never see, as hard as black women to ride for us, you would never see two prominent black women, even if do that in front of a worldwide audience. Like they were in front of the NBA.
Right.
Yeah.
And they said it. It's got to be disconcerting to you.
Well, think about this. If you say that it hurt you, imagine how we as black women feel.
Yeah.
Knowing that we fight, knowing that more often than not, there will not be reciprocity. The fact that we love in the face of hate on both sides, all the way around, and yet we still fight. It's because we love hard that way. And we know that, you know, our families and our communities depend on that. So we keep fighting.
I've watched three black men do some very destructive bullshit. I think that he, the governor of the, excuse me, the attorney general of Kentucky, I think what Charles Barkley and Shaq said was ill-informed. I think if you look at what happened in the Breonna Taylor case, and you look at Ahmaud Arbery, and you look at George Floyd, the difference is, though we were told initially something in all three of those cases. In Ahmaud Arbery, they declined to prosecute those people by a couple of different district attorneys. Mm-hmm. They said it was legal killings. And then we saw the video. And that's when public opinion changed. And we only saw the video in the Ahmaud Arbery case because the defense attorney thought, oh, we'll show them the video and they'll see.
Prove our innocence.
Thought that was a good idea.
He really did. And that really speaks to, and so what happened with George Floyd is people don't remember this, but you remember initially the first district attorney or whoever was going to be in charge of prosecuting the case came out and said, we don't see enough evidence. Even when we watch a man get choked to death, I mean, a knee on his back for 9 minutes, and after people acted out, then the next day he did. And so the difference between Breonna Taylor and George Floyd is that we haven't seen the video yet that makes the prosecutors and the police a liar yet. And right after they said those things, then we have articles in the USA Today and the Washington Post saying the bullet doesn't match.
Ballistic report.
It's different than what the attorney general said, and that they have a video of them being cut off. And I remember going really hard at Charles Barkley, and you said something to me that I had to.
Yeah, I mean, as a friend, I made sure I did this offline. And it was like, you know, I appreciate and I celebrate the fact that you've joined a new fraternity, but I've known you for 20 years.
The
you that I know doesn't hold no cut cards and doesn't stop saying something just because it's a member of a group that you're associated with. So it's like, you know, I kind of wanted to see where you're going to go to hold everybody as accountable as everybody.
I you know, with both Omegas, and I had to check myself because you said, you know, if you feel that way about somebody, you can say what you have to feel. You can have natural disagreement. Yeah. I think that those words have harm and intent and impact on black women's lives. It gives a legitimacy to an illegitimate process.
Yeah,
I've never seen a black man shoot a police officer and get, basically they don't even try him. Then he gets, he stands to make, in terms of a financial settlement, he's gonna get money. So I know that those things don't stand to reason. And I wish that they would have given black women the same benefit that they give an unjust system that is with full of holes in it.
100%.
And you were right. And when you also told me, which I agree with, is just like me and Shaq are the same fraternity, those police departments, those prosecutors, those grand juries, they're in a fraternity too.
They're protecting each other just like you're protecting them. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that protection is what we see now. When you saw Ahmaud Arbery, those people protected him to the extent that they could have lost something.
Yes.
And they protected him to the extent that justice wasn't done. So you can be a part of a thing and really have an allegiance to it, but it does detriment to the population at large. And to me, I think that when you watch black men walk around with say her name and demanding justice, and the world has a black woman's name on her lips, and you say, it ain't the same thing.
Right.
It's so devastating.
It was a shame to see that the shield itself of the NBA did such a good job with the whole movement inside the bubble, that the two people who were on the most popular show representing the league came out.
What were you saying, Jasmine?
Well, no, I was going to say, just because you're a member of fraternity or sorority does not mean you can't call somebody on what is true.
Right.
Basically, when you have a brotherhood or a sisterhood, it gives you even more credence to simply say, hey, I think you were wrong in what you said, and this is why. And I think the same thing should hold true in whether it's a police fraternity and you see one of your, I don't know what you call them, members, whatever, doing wrong, you should call them on that.
Right now you call them defendants. But other than that, I think. But you're right.
I think that's true. You call them on that. You don't just simply say, because we share the same, you know, symbol, that I can't tell you the truth or I can't call you out on something. It makes it even more. But the brotherhood allows us to still remain brothers, even though I tell you you're wrong about something.
And I think that it's just so harmful to me because it really is a time. I've seen, we talked about this earlier, I've seen black women finally being able to, you know, somebody saying her name And then somebody else, then black women took their power and got a black presidential nominee. And it's just an amazing thing. But that is a vastly different thing. And I'll say this. I just think that immediately after they said that, the next day, the USA Today and the Washington Post came out with articles that shed a different light on it. They let us know that all the information we got wasn't out there. And I would challenge them to read those articles and to tell me if you feel the same way. And to be careful when you say things like that, because you give legitimacy to a patently illegitimate process. When you only take the information that edifies your perspective, when you only ask one side of the beat, it's almost like asking a question you already know the answer to and only seeking those answers that give you the answer you want. You only ask those questions that give you the answer they want. And no matter what, a black woman went to bed at night and did not wake up. And somebody should be liable for that. And that you blame, that they always find a way to make us responsible for our own deaths. And that they don't need popular black men to protect them. They have a judicial system. Mm-hmm. They have police officers. They have a corporate structure. They have a system that protects them. You know, they don't need you to edify that perspective. They got it covered. If you miss a lot of free throws, chances are you miss some evidence, too.
Our first guest is the mayor of Stockton, California. He's the subject of the HBO documentary Stockton on My Mind. Please welcome Mayor Michael Tubbs.
How you doing, Your Honor?
Your Honor.
I'm good.
Your Majesty.
Your Highness. What the hell do we call him?
I don't know. Your Highness, Your Majesty, Your Royal Wonder. I don't know.
You are the mayor of Stockton, California. And Stockton, if you've lived in California, Stockton's so scary, people from Oakland don't fuck around in Stockton. That's how it used to be. It really did. It led the nation in homicides. It led the nation in foreclosures. So it was a city that was troubled. So they decided they would elect a 20-something-year-old. Because, you know, last time a 20-something-year-old mayor, black mayor, got elected, it didn't work out good for Detroit. It didn't work out good for them. So you took on a city that obviously was rife with problems, and you have had a level of efficacy that we don't often see in major cities. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, first, thanks for having me. And Stockton's home, and absolutely, like, growing up in Stockton, a lot of the bad reputation you hear. But like any other place that's home, it's not as bad as people think.
Right.
I think the past 3.5 years, what we've seen in terms of a 40% reduction in homicides, in terms of leading the state in declining officer-involved shootings, in terms of rebounding from bankruptcy to being the second most fiscally healthy city in the state, has been by being very smart and data-driven and making decisions, having a good team of people to work with, but also being very clear about government exists to support all people, and that we have to do more for folks that have had done more done against them by government.
You know, it's interesting. Most 20-somethings aren't running cities. They're living in their parents' basements, right? They're like, and getting fat and not getting anybody pregnant is what they're doing. But it's amazing because it's obviously a bit of a novelty for some people to say that your youth would be like a bit of a novelty. But you really have been effective. And that's very interesting because usually when people take a job like that, it certainly doesn't turn around this fast. And sometimes it doesn't at all. But I just wonder, like, you've been innovative and done some things that we haven't ever heard of. And some people would call socialism. But tell us some of those things that you implemented that you think helped.
Yeah, and I think part of it is I started at city council at 22. So I spent 4 years on city council sort of learning city government, which made the learning curve to be mayor, not as steep. And a couple of things we've done. Number one, we were the first city in this country to test this idea of basic income.
What is that?
It's basically we give people $500 a month for the past 20 months. It comes from Dr. King, who was talking about this before he died. And the idea is that America creates so much wealth that poverty economic scarcity and lack are policy choices. And we can't afford actually to live in a society where people aren't working two jobs and still can't pay rent, or people aren't working themselves to death and still can't pay for utilities, or people who are choosing to stay home and take care of their kids still are able to derive some sort of income. So when we started, to your point, people thought we were crazy, we were socialists, but now there's 25 other cities in this country who have joined this group I started called Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, who are saying we want to do this in our cities as well. And in fact, now there's literally bills in Congress from Senator Harris and others that talks about giving people money, at least during COVID, because people aren't able to work, because people are taking real economic hits, and because of people are sheltering in place. And then the second sort of program that we've ran in the city is a scholarship program for every student who graduates from our largest school district. They're guaranteed a scholarship to a two-year school, a four-year school, or a trade school. And I'm excited about that program in particular because I'm the first one in my family to go to college. If I hadn't gone to Stanford for free, there's no way I think I would be back in Stockton, at least so early, doing this work. So I think, to your point about socialism, we're trying to show people that if you invest in people and at least help people make their basic necessities, then a lot of the other things we complain about actually can begin to figure themselves out.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Did you say Stanford? You said Stanford, right? Yeah. Now yes, you're fucking yes. showing off. That's
he
what you're doing.
Honor.
That's what he's doing right now. You know what? I respected you to right now. Right now.
It was right now. A little flex on the right.
and he put it in something. You know, I wouldn't have been able to go to Stanford unlike you motherfuckers.
Right. For free.
Listen, wait a minute.
Go ahead and show off all you want to.
I used to live on Stanford, but that's not the same thing. It's very interesting because that is an innovative mindset, because for too long, this country has an antagonistic relationship to the poor, to the less fortunate. I think they almost think it's like some kind of disease that you can catch, or it's a disease of laziness, of lack of self-motivation. And so there are people who incline, like even now, Andrew Yang expounded on that a little bit. Even now, you'll see a Mark Cuban, who has talked about giving every American $1,000, and particularly during COVID, that's not a novel concept in a lot of European countries, particularly when there is times of upheaval like we're seeing right now. But you were able to pass this. What has been the outcome of that? What has happened with the people that have gotten the program?
Yeah, well, what we've seen is that people spend money how like you and I spend money. So we have spending data that's updated every month, and people are spending money on food, they're spending money on rent, they're spending money on utilities, they're spending money on, during COVID, folks are using that money as they wait for unemployment, which they still have not been able to receive despite qualifying for it. People are using that money to stay home when they're sick because they don't have paid time off, et cetera. And I think for me, part of the reason why we started the program is I grew up in poverty. My mom, she had me as a teenager. So when we talk about poor people and working class people, that's personal to me. That's my mom, that's my aunt, that's my cousins, that's a lot of my friends even now. And I know the issue isn't with them. The issue is with the way our economy is structured. And the fact that the president could make allegedly millions of dollars and only pay $750 in taxes while my folks can't pay rent. They're still paying more than that in taxes.
Speaking of, that's the imbalance of America. Mm-hmm. That's literally the imbalance of America. It was so funny because even when I watched what was going on, you know, with the stimulus package, which cost trillions, it was the largest expenditure by the government in history, and yet prevention and testing and outreach programs would have been more effective. Because my mother always said, you can't do it. If you can't do it right, you're gonna have to do it again. And so I just think that the ways that you're thinking that, you know, 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, people would have thought it was outside the box. They would have thought that it was loony. They would have thought that it was untenable. You're showing that it can work. And we're not talking about it in a small city. We're talking about a large city in a state that has the fifth largest economy in the world, and a city that has had certainly Stockton is quintessentially what people think of the urban plight. You had housing floor closures, you have violence, you have high unemployment. So all of that would have been the kind of whipping boy that America uses to say this is why these kinds of programs won't work. So it can't just be, I don't think it's just introducing them. It had to be managed and kind of massage? Because I know it's had some hiccups. What have some of the drawbacks been to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the drawbacks have been, number one, because it's on debit cards, some folks have decided that they need cash, that so many things require cash. So we don't
Hell yeah, that's what I would do, Your Honor. You see?
Well, but it's not all $500 is taken out, but sometimes you got to get your hair cut. That's like $40, $45 that's cash if your barber doesn't take debit cards. So we're not able to account for 100% of how the money is spent, but even with the money that's taken out of cash, we do follow-up interviews, and through that, we get some insights as to how people are using that money to borrow or to give their kids lunch money, et cetera. And I think the other drawback is that it's just a finite amount of time. So maybe people are making different choices because they know the money will eventually run out. It's not something they get in perpetuity. But even that, I think I'm proud because people were telling me folks were going to buy guns and then I'll be liable for anything that happens because they used the money from the program to do so, or that folks were going to use all the money on drugs and alcohol. And that just hasn't been the case.
No, with my $500, it has. It's been with my $500. But it was my money. I got it for myself. I didn't get it from you. And if the money had glitter on it, that's nobody's business. I don't think we have to talk about that.
It smells great.
You got an HBO special, which is weird because I've had a few of them, but I had to work a lot harder than you did. But I had to write a set. You just had to turn the city around. What is the basis of Stockton on My Mind?
So Stockton on My Mind, it starts kind of with my story. My mom, again, she had me as young. She was 16 when she was pregnant, 17 when I was born. My father's been incarcerated for most of my entire life. So it starts there, but it uses that to really tell a balanced story of the city in terms of other young people in the city who have similar stories and how they're making sense of sort of the programs we're running, the things we're trying to do, and if these ideas actually work on the ground, and if there's a reason to even have hope or believe that government can do anything. So I appreciate it because it starts with me, but it actually tells a deeper story of the city and the people who make my city what it is. So I'm very proud of how it turned out.
It's interesting because you are a melding of two things. Obviously, you started off one way, and then you went to one of the foremost centers for education in the entire world, Stanford. Is about as high as it gets. And so you had these experiences, now you had that one. So you've had your feet planted in two different worlds. Do you think that contributed to the way that you see things, the way that you're kind of able to balance, these people from, these are really divergent experiences?
No, absolutely. I think it's given me a lot of empathy, but also a sense of responsibility, understanding that because I went to a school like Stanford, there's certain rooms I could walk into, certain people I can talk to, certain things I get invited to that I wouldn't get as a black kid.
What do you get invited to that you wouldn't get invited to? What do you get invited to now that you wouldn't have before?
Everywhere. I mean, the DL Uncut TV show.
Yes, damn right. Damn right.
Throw that in there.
He got my vote. I'm moving to Stockton just to vote for this dude.
No, but to your point, I think it's also let me see that the folks I went to school with at Stanford weren't that much smarter or any smarter than the people I went to high school with. They just had oftentimes more resources and more opportunities. And that, when I remember my first class, and I was like, wait, what? This is the game?
They ain't shit. They ain't shit.
But, you know, I think it's really important that we see faces like yours. You know what I mean? Because I think about the young black men who are really driving forces in some of these towns. You know, you've got the black mayor down in Birmingham. You think about the one in Kansas City and also, you know, in other places. And it's good to see young black men in these positions of power so that they are able to debunk, you know, this narrative about black men being, you know, stupid or
criminal.
Criminal or not really engaged or interested in politics and what happens to our community. I think this is very important.
I appreciate that. It's funny because all of us run a group chat together. So we talk all the time, all like the black mayors, period, and also the black male mayors. We have a chat as well. And we just talk all day, especially during this crazy time, bouncing off ideas and talking points and how we're managing and make sure we take care of each other. So it's really great to have people.
If you track most successful black men's life, their journey, their diaspora, there will be a moment a very clear moment where they could have done something differently and for whatever reason they did not. You know, I can recall those moments for me. What would you say the defining moment when you decided this is the world I'm from, but I'm going to go into this one because I think I can be more of more help in this world than I can in that one?
Yeah, I think there's two, really. One was when I was 12 and I visited my father for the first time as a not 2-year-old baby in prison, and sort of walking in, seeing just how sad everyone was, seeing how all the men in the visiting room were either Black or Latino, and talking to him and hearing him talk about how the system had been designed in such a way that for him to end up in jail. And I remember him saying that, you know, people only expect you to do one of two things, to be in prison or dead. You're Black, you're poor, your mom had you young, you're from a city like Stockton. And I remember taking that really to heart, and from then being really, really focused and motivated to just prove him and everyone else wrong. And then in college, while I was interning for President Obama, one of my cousins, Donnell James, was murdered in Stockton. And that's what caused me to actually go back to Stockton. Because before then, once I got accepted to college, me and my mom both knew that I was not going to come back, that that was not the plan. The plan was to leave. But after my cousin was murdered, that's what made me stop and think about all the success, all these opportunities had to be for something bigger than just me to be happy. And that's why I decided to run for city council the next year.
It's interesting because there's an old saying, a prophet has no honor amongst his own. And I think it's difficult for someone to come back, to have been in a different world and to come back and to be kind of respected in the world that they left. And you seem to be able to navigate. You seem to be able to manage that pretty well. Is there anything that you think nationally, because now we have a big election come up, and the focus from the Democratic side is on young Black men like you. Young Black men who are apathetic, young Black men who believe the system has failed them, young Black men who think that their vote doesn't matter, that there's nothing in it for them. And you are a living, breathing example of how things can and ought work. What would you say to them?
Yeah, what I've been saying is that, number one, your vote only matters because you matter. Your life, your experiences, the things you go through, you are the closest to the pain, so you're the closest to the solution. And because of that, we need you to vote. But if your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't be spending millions of dollars to create laws.
When they steal mailboxes from Black neighborhoods, you know they don't want us to vote. When they steal mailboxes from our neighborhoods, you know they don't want
us
to vote.
You know.
Or literally create laws, like create rules. Like, hey, Florida, if you got fines, you can't vote. Like,
right.
Like literally our vote is, they have foreign governments. Like Putin and his folks are in Russia right now with a whiteboard trying to figure out how to get us not to vote because of the power we have. If you look at this country's history, anytime this country has moved forward, it's because Black folks have exerted political power.
And that's every time. You know, it's interesting because the thing that you're talking about right now, to make Black men vote, you have to make them feel invisible. You have to make them feel not worthy, like no one can see them. And I think that Black women have had that same struggle. They found a way to assert a sense of self-worth, a value of understanding how to harness power. And I think it's a lesson that we all need to learn. And I think one of the positive things, I've never gotten a chance to meet so many young Black men who are from the same streets that many of us are from. They ate the same food. They ran from the same bullies. They had the same experiences. And yet they are the driving forces. Do you understand that as California goes, the cities in California go, the state goes? So what you're doing right now is really kind of a template for what could start to be replicated all over the country. And the fact that a Black man found it, that a young Black man was integral and instrumental in bringing that to the forefront, makes an old man like me feel very good. So you think, you obviously are aspiring to be something. I know you want to be something else in the political realm. What would that be?
I want to be effective. I want to continue to push the envelope and make it so that the country doesn't just paint Black Lives Matter on the ground, but we know Black Lives Matter by the policies and by the outcome. So whether that's in the elected office or in something else, I'm motivated and dedicated to using at least the time I have here to make that real.
Damn, that's much better than what I said.
That was a political answer, boy.
That would be effective.
Stanford's way better than Compton College. Let me tell you that. It's way better. It's way better. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for joining us,
man.
And good luck to you. You keep blazing that trail, and I'll keep blazing that other thing.
And let me just say one thing, though. So I grew up watching you on Comic View with my mom. Like, that's literally what I spent my childhood doing. That's
I knew it.
That's why I talk crazy to people at the council meetings. They used to call out the audience members. I do the same thing.
Thank you, man. Thank you. I knew I was working. Thank you, Your Honor. We appreciate it. Thank you.